Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we've got a special episode for you here with one of our favorite guys. We haven't talked to him for a while, but we're excited to have him back. Ladies and gentlemen, yeah. Jim Zub. Jim, welcome back.
Hey. Thank you for having me once again. I don't know how many times it's been, but every time in the club is wonderful. So it's great to be back.
In the club. That's what we call it.
In the club. That's right.
Out the club, in the club.
Exactly. That's right.
Taking a nap in the club. That's us.
We're ostensibly here to talk about Conan number 25, which is going to be on sale October 8th. And there's some fun stuff to talk about there, as well as the other stuff you're working on. But I wanted to start off wishing you a happy Sumerian September. Did I get that right? What's going on there?
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a guy, a YouTuber named Michael Vaughn, and he's been doing YouTube videos about sort of Robert E. Howard and the Highborn Age and stuff for years now. And he christened this thing a few years ago called Sumerian September. And so he encourages people to go, you know, back to the source material, to read the original short stories of Robert E. Howard, the guy who created Conan the Barbarian. But to read everything sort of related to his works, because Howard did all sorts of stuff beyond Conan. So even though it's called Sumerian September, I think it's just sort of an all around general celebration of the character. Like, Conan's older than Superman. He's one of the, you know, oldest literary kind of pop culture characters. And so it's, it feels weird to be part of that legacy and amazing at the same time. So like last year, I did a whole series of blog posts where I went through the original Conan stories and looked at them now as someone who's working on the property, and kind of what I love about those stories and which ones are really memorable to me, and things that I had sort of forgotten, you know, digging through the original text and stuff like that. So, yeah.
I mean, this segues nicely into something I wanted to ask you that comes dangerously close to where do you get your ideas? So I won't exactly ask that.
But no worries.
You've been, like you said, there's a really long legacy of Conan, and you've been writing a ton of it for a couple of years here now. So what keeps it fresh for you? What keeps you interested in Conan?
That's a good question. So I discovered the reprint editor who does the stuff at Heroic and Titan now, who is publishing Conan, they got in touch with me at one point and let me know that as of now, I've written the second most number of Conan comics after Roy Thomas.
Now, that's crazy.
Now, Roy has the most, like, you'll never catch him, and, you know, hundreds and hundreds. But, I've got around just over 60 issues of Conan that I've written across Dark Horse, Marvel, and now at Titan. So it is amazing to me sometimes, because I think to myself, man, do I have more ideas, you know? And we've got this grand kind of epic planned out. When I signed on for this big publishing relaunch that we did in 2023, it was part of this broader plan of what can we do with Conan that feels traditional and feels, you know, like the stories that you grew up on, but not just retelling them, not just adapting the existing, you know, the original Howard works or other stuff like that. How could we create that kind of excitement month to month with cliffhangers and the unexpected? And that's, you know, that's a weird balancing point where you have a certain number of ingredients. Like if you go to a restaurant, a Mexican restaurant, you want to have Mexican ingredients. You want to have those kinds of things, but how can you combine them? What fusion kind of stuff can we bring into it? Or what kind of things can we do to surprise you? And that's kind of been the thing for me, is that challenge of looking at those existing works and saying, okay, not we have to have these characters or this exact same plot, but what are the overarching kind of things that need to happen? There's always, you know, it was called Weird Tales Magazine for a reason. There has to be something supernatural, something beyond, something fantastical that happens in a Conan story. There has to be some sort of, you know, deep action. There has to be intensity and a sense of survival at stake and things like that. And then it's, okay, change the location, change the kind of opponents, limit the character. I think you do the same thing with any other iconic character. You know, it's funny. Yeah. People generally don't ask guys writing Batman or Superman or Spider-Man, are you sick of writing Spider-Man? You know, like they're like, no, the superheroes, it feels like it's a bottomless well of ideas and cross-pollination. And I don't think there's any difference with Sword and Sorcery. You're putting a character through trials. You're putting them through challenges and trying to understand what made that thing so popular in the first place. And then tap into all those bits, you know? So the classic idea of whatever Spider-Man is, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. So how do you tinker with that formula? What kind of power? What kind of responsibility? How do you contrast that with other characters who don't treat the world the way that Peter Parker does? So I think the same thing is sort of true with Conan. Conan may not have that perfect sentence that encompasses the character, but a character who is a survivor, who, you know, fights against anything that the world throws at them, that will not let themselves be beat down, that will go into, you know, unknown places, and the world kind of breaks around their sword and around their will, I think is a universal constant. That's why the character is an icon, you know, in an era of all kinds of characters that were created in the 30s, this one sticks because there's something intrinsic about it. And so it's about exploring those kinds of things, pushing that character and pulling and putting them through the paces, and it keeps me out of trouble for sure.
Well, I feel like Conan has the sort of here we go again energy of like, okay, I have to kill this weird shaped thing.
Well, I think what's amazing about it is that the character, you know, people, there's a term my friend Robin Laws, I think, came up with it called a procedural character. We don't want Conan to change, whether it's Conan in his youth, he's sort of impetuous and troublemaking, or in his prime when he's the leader of men or whatever, or he's the grizzled king. In those, each of those eras, we want to see him be the exemplary version of himself. But what are the challenges we can put them up against? What are the environments we can put him in? Then see how he reacts in that kind of a way.
And what I was going to say is, like, in the last arc that you finished, it struck me like he has that. He's sort of with this companion that he doesn't really like, but they have to work together. Right. And the part that struck me was the very intensely emotional end to the book. And that's what, like, you're talking about, like, trying to, like, bring in the old feeling to. And I think the narration, like, it's such a vibe that you don't get. It's very unique to Conan in my estimation of it. But then the heavy emotional punch of the end of that story was like breathtaking. Yeah. And I feel like that's it really hit me. And that's the combination I feel like is really working with, like you're saying, feel like refreshing.
Robert E. Howard's original storytelling, if you get a chance to read those short stories, they are punchy and pulpy because they were short stories in Weird Tales. The vast majority of the official Conan writing of that period, they're short stories. Some of them are 6,000 words, 8,000 words, 12,000 words. You can read them in a sitting. And because of that, they have to be, there's no fat on them. Like, they just instantly sort of drive into entertainment, whether that's violence or drama or intensity or atmosphere. And that taught me a lot when I went back to that source material and I'm reading it, and how quickly it summons a vision in my mind of a place or of a moment or of tension. And I'm like, okay, we need to be able to not, again, just copy that one for one, but think about, are we tuning the dials in that way? And then one of the brilliant things that I think Roy did in the 70s, and in an interview, he said he realized he couldn't do sound effects for Conan, that if you did, it would just be slash, slash, ugh, ugh. People are getting killed everywhere. But he had to, he had to summon the lyricism that he got, and the feeling, the poetry that is in that, those original short stories. And the minute you do that, you're contrasting what you're seeing on the panel with what you're reading, or in some cases they're homogenous, but the way they're doing it is he's telling you things that you can't experience unless you're there. So he's talking about the coppery smell of blood in the air, or the tension of the thews of the muscles, or things like that. And so all of a sudden, it almost is the comic equivalent of like a Michael Bay movie. Like it's going to go into slow mo and it takes on this gravitas of every slice and every explosion of energy suddenly feels so much more important and so much more intense. It's no longer just slash slash ugh or thwip or bam, bam or whatever. It's the world is shaking and the atmosphere is, you know, and the teeth are gritting and you're reading about all this atmospheric information or the sense of internal thoughts of the characters, but it's not a first person narration. It's like there's this heady Shakespearean narrator telling you how badass this all is. And so you can't help but sort of be, if you know, you get into that kind of thing, you get swept up in the poetry of it. And I think with other characters, it would feel really purple. You would be like, oh, this is a little much. Yeah, and yet for some reason, when it's these badass...
Spider-Man,
you
know, swung through the canyon. It was like a... the with
every moment of
up.
Tension. His head splits, you know, like an egg as the spider sense tears him asunder. You'd just be like, that's a little
like,
much.
Okay, but for some, cool it.
With Conan, it's totally... You know, it's the right way to do it. And so something like in issue 24, we have this really tragic ending. And when I'm describing that to Fernando Dagnino to draw it, and I'm saying we need this moment to moment, you know, Conan trying to save this person whose death now is inevitable and he can't stop it. And then that realization sort of shuts down. That felt like a very 70s kind of Conan moment. And the way Roy would kind of do stuff, I remember an issue of Conan, I can't remember the issue number, where one of Conan's friends has been captured by the town militia or whatever, and he thinks he can save them, and he doesn't get there in time, and the guy gets hung. And then there's this moment of Conan just stark watching, but we don't see the guy die. It's all Conan's reaction, and then him realizing he's too late, and he walks away. And I was sort of like, you can tune that up. We can do those kinds of moments. And then when I got that artwork in, I'm writing it plot style. So I'm doing it very much like the 70s, you know, Stan or Roy. And then when I get the art, that's when I dialogue it.
Oh, that's awesome. It
was like, okay, I've got the art right in front of me. I can't go too dramatic. I can't go too lyrical. It's beautiful. It's absolutely stunning work. Now it's a matter of me trying to live up to that artwork and deliver a cohesive package, you know?
I mean, I think that's a nice segue into talking about Coda number 25, which, as we mentioned, coming out October 8th. And this is fully painted by Alex Swirley. I believe you said it took him a year to put together.
So it wasn't the sole project that Alex was doing. Okay. He does magic cards and he does other illustrations. He did a bunch of covers for us in Savage Sword and things like that. But I knew I wanted 25 to be special. So it's not our last issue. I know typically it feels like every time a book hits double digits, you're looking over your shoulder like, all right, when's it canceled with a new number one? But it's not. I'm on the book long term. I've signed a long term contract on Conan. I'm going to be on for at least 50 issues. So I'll be on Conan through end of 2027.
Well, sorry, just to interrupt there. That's a good amount of job security for the comic book.
It's great.
So that's going to feel nice.
It's stunning, actually. Yeah. So the great thing is Conan does really well in the foreign market and they don't want to shake the tree. It's doing amazing in North America. You know, we've picked up more languages now. Conan's in 11 languages around the world. And so I'm getting international invites like I've never had before. And that consistency means I can build and pay off. So I can foreshadow stuff. Like we had a moment of foreshadowed in issue one that then we then paid off in issue 13. Or we've had multiple times where it was like issue 5 or 6, we had another moment that then I paid off in the issue 22, you know, so it's like these elements where I can build up that narrative and know we're going to get that dramatic payoff. And if you don't like it, it's my fault instead of it being like editorial fiat and man, that plot line just seemed to peter out. And you're like, well, you know, now I know I'm going to be able to really architect it out and deliver the goods, which is a really amazing feeling for me. So perfect example is we can plan out crazy far in advance. And so our art teams have like issue 25 is imminent. It's now coming out in a few weeks, which is mind blowing to me. And I'm already writing like issue 32, you know? That means the art teams have tons of time. They can put all their best qualities on the page and it's going to be beautiful. And the perfect example of that is 25. So I knew it was going to be special. I pitched to, you know, Heroic, who were the rights holders of Conan. I was like, look, I want this to be a real cool celebration. I want it to be an all-encompassed adventure. You get a beginning, middle, and an end all in one issue. Well, you know, oversized, and we need to like get the killer art team for this. And then the discussion came, well, if we got like an illustrator, someone who's going to do all the artwork, color and line art. And then we were talking who could do it. And Alex had been doing these phenomenal covers for us on Savage Sword. And he actually had, reached out to Editor and said he would love to do a story, not just covers. And they were like, well, I know you were probably thinking like a 10 or 12 pager in Savage Sword, maybe some ink wash thing. What if we pitch you this bigger idea? What if we did this like 36 page epic? And he's like, that's a ton of work. We were like, yep, how much time do you need? And this was last September. This is a year ago. And he looked and he said, get me the script as soon as possible. I need to start sketching right now. And wow. So I got him a broad outline. He started sketching character designs and his sort of take on King Conan, because this is my first King Conan story and the first, well, we've had a King Conan story in Savage Sword, but this is like a very specific kind of era of the character and my first time writing the character in an extended narrative. So it was like, all right, I got him that thing as early as I could. And he spent literally a year painting it. So almost every week, after that initial design period and things, he would send rough sketches in, and then we would start to get a painting and then the next series of rough sketches and then a painting. And so almost every Monday I would like open my inbox and there's an oil painting that he sent me a photo of. Wow. These are not digital. This is literally, traditional, beautiful, stunning artwork. And oil is really hard to work with. And
I'm asking, how big are they in real life?
So some of they vary in sizes, I think, depending on the detail, right? So like a double page spread of Tarantia, the capital of Aquilonia, is massive, right? Because he wants to show the castle walls and all this stuff. And then I think he probably saved himself on some of the conversation scenes where he's like, okay, thank God I can get a little bit smaller and what may have.
Yeah, I gotta say, I was just gonna say, this sounds very cool, but also a absolute nightmare for the printing process.
God. Yeah. Like, the tuning in terms of like sending those original the scans in or whatnot. I'm not sure how they scanned them all in, and then doing the minor color tweaks and what may have you, and then the lettering process. But the same kind of thing, I sent him an outline and I didn't do the lettering until we had all the artwork. So then I've got these 30 plus oil painting pages in front of me, and I'm like, man, I'm an audacious bastard. What am I doing here? Like, you got to live up to this thing and in many ways give it the room that it deserves. So get out of the way on some of that text and let it breathe. One of the things that was cool, it's an anniversary issue, so I had to include some old moments of Conan. So he had got to do greatest hits collection of some of the classic stories, kind of re-showing them in big, beautiful, insane, rendered imagery. It's stunning. And if people hate the story, man, they're going to get their money's worth out of the art. And I think they're going to like the story, but I don't want to be, assume anything. I wrote this very much like a fable. It feels a bit like Arthurian, like the Green Knight or something. Yeah. This mysterious figure comes to Aquilonia and he wants to challenge the king to prove and see if he's worthy of his legend, essentially. And he puts him through these sort of supernatural trials and all this kind of stuff. And so it gave me the ability to go big, go epic, give Alex just this palette to go wild with what he does best, beautiful, stunning, atmospheric imagery. And then, try and, like I said, put as much of that gravitas and lyricism in it, celebrate what's so cool about the character. And then to kind of bring it full circle, for the variant covers, we got everyone who's done interior art on the series so far. So Alex did the A cover, but then Roberto De La Torre and Doug Braithwaite and Danica Breen and, Fernando Dagnino and Jonas Scharf, everyone who's worked on the main series and on the Battle of the Blackstone event book that we did, then did a variant. So it was like everyone on the team, everyone that's been with us, for this process so far, got to be part of the big high five. So it's really extra special for everyone.
When will one of those paintings be hanging above your on your mantle?
Oh man, I don't know how much they're going to go for. We were talking about all sorts of funky things. Like he's not offering any of it for sale anytime soon. I think he wants to sort of hold on to them for a while. But I would love. It's so funny. Just over the weekend, Mike Ruth, he's an artist here in the Greater Toronto area, and he did a signing at a shop out in Oakville, and I popped out there to see him because we did a story in the latest Savage Sword, this sort of Neanderthalic supernatural tale, and he gifted me a page of art from that, and I'm just so, whenever you can get that original artwork from someone you collaborate with, it's so extra special and kind of all around my house, like literally right here is a page from Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons that Troy Little gave me. And I glance over at it every so often, like, yeah, pretty good. Not the art, the art's phenomenal, but like, that was a cool idea. That was fun. You know? So, you know, stuff like that. Every creative project is a time capsule, and working on Conan right now feels so weird to be in the midst of it, you know, because people are really loving it and it's super exciting. But I know where I was as we made each issue, and I know 25 is just going to be this massive kind of creative milestone for me and all of us who've had the chance to contribute to it. So.
Another great segue, Jim, because I want to talk about probably the earliest project we ever talked to you about, which was Skull Kickers, which is coming out as compact attack editions, I believe what they're called.
That's right. In
three volumes next year. This is kind of like the DC compact comics, but it's coming out through Oni Press. What is it like looking back on those, and have you rejiggered anything in these?
You know, it's so funny. So Skull Kickers is this, I joke that it's like the magic spell that kind of created my career. I did some comic book stuff before that, some webcomic things, but Skull Kickers was the one that really put me on the map for a lot of people. And it was a slow build, you know, and it taught me so much about just regularly putting out creative work and collaborating with other people and building the kind of story that I would enjoy as a reader. And then it found it, you know, its readership. And over the years, as I've done more and more sword and sorcery stuff, people always kind of find it their way back to it. And it had been like some of the volumes were out of print at Image, and the big deluxe editions that we had done a lot, again, were mostly out of print. And it was sort of like, okay, how are we going to approach this? What's the best way to do it? And there was talk of potentially doing an omnibus, but I thought, you know, I actually find reading an omnibus really annoying. Personally, I like put them on my knees, and they look amazing on the shelf. But
I was
not
just going
to
say, very cool over there. When you have
shelf
to be like,
porn is great. It's great.
You can't go anywhere besides like on your couch. No, if you're like, oh, I want to read like, on the plane.
It sounds corny, but it's true. Like the kids love that compact format and that manga, you know, kind of midway format. And I'm like, I want the most number of people to be reading this. I want the most people to discover it. I want a price point that's really going to hit for everyone. And so we talked about these compacts, and that's, you know, going to Oni with it feels extra special as well, because I've had so much fun working with them on the Rick and Morty stuff. And so it's great. It's going to be in print. It's going to be available. It's going to be everywhere. They're pushing it really deep in the book chains. I'm going to have them at conventions again, whereas it would always be spotty whether I would have copies. And I can point now all these Conan readers and these Dungeons and Dragons readers and fans and say, look, if you like that, this is where it all started. This was the first mistake on a road of, you know, ridiculousness to come. And so it's so extra special to me. But as you were saying, like, you look back at that material and you're like, huh, you know, I've learned a lot. I feel like it still holds up and it's still a lot of fun, but it's fun to see the seeds of whatever, the plants that will grow later, or whatever kind of analogy I want to use. And getting in touch with Edwin and Misty, the original art team on the series, and being like, hey, do you want to do new covers? How you been? What's new? You know, we'll see each other at conventions in passing. But it was fun to kind of reattack all that stuff and celebrate it again. That's what I feel like all this stuff's like. I'm not in my elder years where it's all about, you know, looking back, but there is a full circle kind of quality to it that feels very special. Yeah.
It's really funny hearing like that size of comic, like especially with my kids. Like I feel like I grew up and it was like comics became so precious. Like and before us, it was like, this is basically garbage, throw them away. And then it was like, so precious, hold on to them, bag them, multiple copies. And now I feel like it's going back the other way with my kids, that they're not that they're throwing them away, but it's just like, I love this. I'm going to dog ear it and I'm going to hold
it. But I love that they're reading it. That's what's most important to me. Don't get me wrong, the collectability is fine and the variant covers and all that stuff, whatever. I get that that's the nature of that end of the market, but I want people to read the books. Like I want people to tell me what part of the story grabbed them, that this is their favorite for these reasons, not just because that cover looks cool and they've slabbed it and it's tucked away because they think it's going to be worth a hojillion dollars. Like I make stories to be told and we create art on those pages. Like if it's slabbed away, I know it's not, but it might as well be blank. I can't interact with that thing anymore.
Right.
And so I kind of love, like, I've got whatever, Scourge of the Serpent here. This comes out this week. That's our Conan event book for the fall. And when I get my comp copies of anything, the box comes in and I crack it open. I always take the top one out. I show it to my wife and we have this little ritual. And I'll say to her, hey, look, I made a comic. And she goes, oh, yeah? And I go, yeah. And she goes, you should keep doing that. I'm like, I think I will. And I've done that like hundreds and hundreds of times, you know, and we joke about it. But it's the thing, the making of the thing and the celebrating of the thing and the flipping through and being like, hey, it printed okay. It looks good. You know, I'm happy with it or whatever. And then on to the next one, on to the next one. So
I want to ask you a question. This is very left field, and it has nothing to do with these books, but I feel like you're a person who is uniquely qualified to answer this, and it's something that I've been mulling over for the past couple of weeks. So a couple of weeks back, we rewatched Stranger Things with my family.
Oh, yeah.
For my son, it was the first time. He's 11. My daughter had watched it before.
The perfect time, by the way.
It was great. Right. He was like enraptured the entire time. Loved it. But one of the things that I was really focused on this rewatch was the way that they're threading through Dungeons and Dragons, which, again, is something that like my son is kind of obsessed with. He goes to a after-school games thing. They play Dungeons and Dragons once a week, etc. He was asking me a lot of questions
about it. Is what you're thinking, Jim. The way you're there, you're
Yes. We get one. No. My question, this is like a very, very long-winded question, but one of the things that I was thinking about is like, given that we're heading into the final season here, we're sort of stretching over like 10 years of this show.
Sure.
And I started thinking about like, oh, around the time that Stranger Things came out, we started to see in pop culture a resurgence of Dungeons and Dragons, certainly like for versus my youth, a reappropriation and mainstreaming of it as well. And as somebody who is one of the co-creators of Dungeons and Dragons meets Stranger Things, I was curious, like, where do you see Stranger Things place in terms of this? Because there are a lot of different things happening at the same time.
I think so D&D has gone through waves, obviously. You know, you've got the initial surge of popularity amongst, you know, the nerd kind of culture, and then it explodes a little more into the mainstream in the 80s, but that's also when you get the Satanic Panic, which sort of seems to put a cap on a certain level of mainstreamedness to it. But now you have generations of creative people who are in whatever the halls of power in terms of Hollywood and publishing and things like that, and it's beloved in a way that I think none of us could have ever imagined. And now, because whatever, you know, every generation has their boogeyman and what is destroying the youth, you know, what musical thing and what artistic thing and what may have you. And it's phenomenal to see D&D come back around and become beloved in schools and libraries, that it's getting kids off screens, that it's making them socialize and interact with each other and all these other things. It's all the stuff that I was feeling when I was a kid. So I started playing around the same era as the Stranger Things kids in the early to mid 80s. And to me, it was always an amazing creative kind of an exercise. It was always this phenomenal thing, and it lit a creative fire in me that has never died. I would not be a writer today without D&D and that desire to entertain and create instead of passively reading or viewing entertainment. And so it's funny to me to see, this is going to sound way cockier than I intend, the rest of the world catch up, you know what I mean? Like that this is a really special thing and a fun thing and an amazing thing that more people should be doing, because it's a creative outlet. And there's very few times in our lives that we get to be the center of attention. Like, yeah, you get to order your coffee at Starbucks and choose whatever you want or what may have you, but like, you get to make big choices and your friends get to respond to it and interact and all those kinds of things without it causing any harm and only entertainment, you know? And that's kind of what's so exciting for me. But there's sort of this, it's a series of things, and you'd need to look very carefully at what came first in terms of the timing. There's Stranger Things hits, and that's got this big, right as that 80s nostalgia was really kind of taking hold, I think, in a really fun kind of way. Then you've got guys like, you know, Stephen Colbert, who was starting to talk about it more. He's always talked about Lord of the Rings, but then he started talking a little bit more about Dungeons and Dragons in that broader kind of scope. And then Critical Role hits and live play, the kind of YouTube live play culture, which is now a weird thing to me, where you're taking an interactive medium and now you're making it an entertainment watching medium again. But then people are not only watching those game tables, they're also going, wait, that's not hard to do. I could do that. My friends could do that. and learning the game through example in a way that we just never had those kinds of outlets, you know? And so it's been this phenomenal thing to see and then to be a tiny part of. Like, my wife and I do a series of books called The Dungeons and Dragons Young Adventurers Guides. And those were kind of taking all the things I was excited about D&D when I was a kid and just giving you all those options in these visual guidebooks. And they were supposed to be three books, and now we're working on book 9 and 10. And it's like, those books are in multiple languages. We get fan mail from kids in like Spain and France and like all over the place telling us about their D&D characters. And it is mainstream now. It is mainstream in a way that I never could have really ever imagined. And I think Stranger Things is a really important pillar of that kind of thing. But I do think both the video games, stuff like Baldur's Gate 3, and Critical Role is also a really important pillar in that kind of structure that is built up and has mainstreamed the whole medium. Yeah.
Yeah. The D&D to comedian pipeline has always been strong in my time. Right. Like, it was basically like improv class before improv class existed.
It is improv class. Yes. It is. Yeah.
And it's just such a, like, cause I never played, it was just never around where I grew up in the country. Like, it wasn't, I never even really heard of it except for the 80s cartoon. I was like, this is awesome. I didn't even know you could do it with your friends.
Right.
Then now so many people that I've worked with over the years, it's like the prime focus for them. But I do have a question. So when the books come in, the one you do with your wife, who do you guys go to and say, we made a comic book? We made a book.
When we made the Young Adventurers guys?
Do you say it to each other? Or does she say it to you? How does it work?
I don't think
we
did
that ritual.
Is there a
third person in the relationship that you talked to?
Yeah, how do you get to the next?
So Andrew Wheeler is our co-writer on those as well. So we should obviously hold a copy up and go, hey, look, we all made a book together, you know? So that would be a fun kind of thing to do. Stacy's doing a bunch of different stuff now for D&D. Those books have obviously kind of helped put her on the map. They announced a D&D crochet book. So they're all these crochet patterns. And at first you think to yourself, what is this, like, D&D lifestyle, coffee table? Like, what is this stuff? And yet what we didn't realize was, so she was part of this team that put together this crochet book. She did all the, I know it sounds weird to say lore, but she did all the lore and kind of the broader stuff that's in there. And I guess there's a lot of people, when they play D&D, they do cross stitch or they do knitting or they do crochet. Right. Like, it's just something for them to do with their hands while they're at the table or while they're in front of the camera doing a Zoom call or whatever with their friends playing Dungeons and Dragons. I didn't know that was a thing. Apparently that's a thing. And so this book got announced in August, and Random House saw this insane social media surge around it, like people freaking out. And Stacy's already getting like messages and fan mail, and this thing hasn't even come out yet.
That's amazing. That's
and,
so cool.
And Random House's marketing arm is like, wait, what? And all of a sudden they're like, we need to pay more attention to this. We need to put more resources into it, because it got more kind of interest than a lot of the recent game book announcements, which is crazy. And so it's funny to see, again, that ripple of broader kind of pop culture and the mainstreamingness of it, that the whatever the crochet community is like, oh, I'm going to make a beholder tonight or whatever. Like, in a million years, you would have told me that we would be living in this time. But then again, when I was a kid, I just wanted one good Spider-Man movie, right? Like, the idea of interconnected 30 plus movies and TV shows, you know, in the Marvel Universe and entertainment, that was the kind of stuff you would say on the playground. Like, can you imagine if there were, you know, the Avengers came together after they did, you know, five movies of separate characters? You're like, yeah, okay, whatever, you know,
watch your Marvel Hulk on TV. Please stop.
Yeah, exactly.
I can imagine a young Jim out there trying to disrupt the crochet market as a dream. And here you are, you and your wife making it happen.
That was my plan all along. When I was in high school, I said, man, crochet forever. It's going to be the biggest thing. It's crazy.
Let's bring it back to the comics before we start to wrap up here. So, like we said, Conan number 25 is on sale on October 8th. Like you said, you got Conan Sword of the Serpent. That's coming out this next week. Is that...
Literally, so we're recording, the week we're recording it, issue one hits Wednesday, September 24th. And so, yeah, we're super, super pumped. I've also got a story in the Predator anthology series that Marvel's got coming out. So Predator, Black, White, and Blood, number 3. I've got Conan. I've got the Predator killing pirates, which is going to be awesome.
Oh, that's awesome.
Super fun. I'm just used to saying the word Conan now.
I bet you are.
It's like, so Conan swinging around the city and his spider sense goes off. That's what's going to be for the rest of my career now. It is an amazing feeling, though, to meet a bunch of people who are loving the books and into what I'm doing. In the Conan comics, they have these credits where we've given everyone jaunty nicknames, like yes. It's the 60s or 70s. So mine is Grim Jim Zub. And I'll come to conventions now, and not a small number of people will come by the table and they'll go, wait, you're Grim Jim. And I was just like, well, clearly you've started reading my work on Conan. Like that has now imprinted that it's like someone saying Stan the Man or whatever. It feels very surreal, but kind of fun at the same time. So.
And I bet you didn't know you were giving yourself a lifelong nickname when you said,
well,
I'll
be Grim
Jim. I
didn't even give myself the nickname. The first editor on the Conan series, Matt Murray, put those in the book without telling any of us. And so we opened that first issue and we were like, wait, what? Oh, this is
That's
awesome.
Funny.
And we thought it might be just a temporary thing. And then the amount of fan mail we got where people were like, I love this. Like it was something they called out. And we were like, all right. So now whenever a new artist comes on board or colorist or anyone comes on the team, it's always this fun thing where we're going to come up with, you know, a nickname for them as well. Yeah, it's always great.
Love that. That's awesome, Jim. Congrats on everything.
Thank
really
you.
Looking forward to checking out Conan number 25. Love everything you're doing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Hopefully we can talk very soon.
That would be amazing. You guys are always awesome. And if you're not digging into the Hyborian Age right now, it is a wonderful time for sword and sorcery adventure. You don't need to know any of the past stories of Conan. You don't have to have read the material. You don't even have to have seen the movies or played the video games. But if you have done any of those things, this book is definitely for you. And even if you haven't, there is lots of awesome action to come.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.